LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Welcome to the May edition of First Thursday, the podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. I am Will Acheson, and I'll be taking you through what I think is a review of a pretty exciting month in public safety labor relations issues. Here are some highlights of what we're going to cover in this podcast. We're going to start off with recent changes made by the largest public safety pension system in the country, CalPERS, to its actuarial rules. And I'll talk about some of the bargaining implications of those changes. I'll cover developments that have been occurring in contracts and labor relations. What are recent settlements that you see out there? We have a couple of areas of free speech that I think are pretty important to talk about. I think most importantly, a federal court of appeals decision on whether no confidence votes are potentially constitutionally protected, and a couple more cases illustrating how really constricted free speech rights are when public safety employees are speaking in the course of their jobs. I'll turn to a bombshell decision out of the Texas Supreme Court holding that under Texas law, there is no right to representation under Weingarten, under the Texas statutory scheme. I'll also talk about the latest in a series of on-call cases and the latest in a series of cases involving the Brady Rule, and then a fascinating case that I think could be a very important blueprint for us when we get into arbitration, particularly in disciplinary cases. Fascinating case from a nationally recognized arbitrator on what remedies usually obtain in arbitration. Can you receive things like attorney's fees or missed overtime and that sort of stuff? So hold on to your hats. We're going to go through a lot over the course of the next hour, and it's going to be a pretty busy podcast. And let's start with pensions, and probably the most significant thing that has happened with respect to public safety employee pensions in a long, long time. On April 17th of this year, the board for California's largest public employer's pension system, known as CalPERS, decided to make some actuarial changes. Before we get into those changes, let's talk a little bit about CalPERS and the challenges that it faces. First of all, CalPERS' size is almost staggering. The value of CalPERS' pension fund is $255 billion, more than the value of most countries in the world. The fund is in trouble. It's in and has been in trouble fairly seriously since the 2007 recession. CalPERS is today only 70% funded, far below the level that actuaries think is necessary for a healthy pension plan. And what that amount might be as to what actuaries say varies depending upon the actuaries, but it's at least somewhere in the 80 to 85% range. It is not in the 70% range. CalPERS has been doing a little bit better since the start of the recession. The funding level was down as low as 61%, and it's now up to 70%. But there are a lot of funding time bombs that are ticking in CalPERS, set to go off in the future. And what the CalPERS board has done is to try to address some of those time bombs. And what it did was basically two things. First of all, it changed a amortization policy as to when or how it allocated both increases to the fund and decreases to the fund over time, investment returns. It has changed the policy from being a 30-year rolling period that continued to move and change every year to a 30-year fixed rate. It is estimated that that will significantly increase employer contributions. The second thing that CalPERS did was to move to a different, what's called smoothing period, where spikes in pension fund returns and losses are smoothed over a period of time. CalPERS had used a 15-year smoothing period. It will move to a 5-year smoothing period, which will make the impact of short-term losses all the greater. How much is this going to affect employer contributions in California? Hold on to your hat for this one. Right now, the average public safety retirement plan under CalPERS has an employer contribution of 30.8% of salary, 30% of salary. Under the new changes, that rate will go up to 41.3% of salary. In other words, employers are going to have to find, on the average, about 9.5% of the salaries of all police officers and deputy sheriffs, corrections officers, and the like, going to have to find that much extra money next year. Now, that high contribution rate will gradually go down over time, and the eventual result is that by 2045, more than 30 years out from now, the unfunded liability will be paid down. And this news that employers who are already fiscally strapped are going to have to come up with more money, this news may only be the first shoe that is dropping, because the CalPERS actuaries are considering changing the discount rate as well. The discount rate is when actuaries try to figure out how much a pension plan is worth in the future, it's the anticipated rate of return on investments. And the CalPERS actuaries are considering reducing the discount rate. And the CalPERS actuaries are also considering increasing the mortality assumption. Mortality assumption means how long, on the average, retirees live after they retire. And there's been a fair amount of evidence that public safety employees are, in fact, living longer than the mortality rates that are built into many public employee pension plans. CalPERS is considering increasing those mortality assumptions. The early estimates are that a change in the discount rate would increase costs by around, employer costs, 3 to 4%, and that the change in the mortality assumption, another 3 to 4%. In short, what we're going to see in California, and by extension, because ripples go out from California around the rest of the country, what we're going to see in California is a huge squeeze on the amount of money that is available in the bargaining process. We may well be looking at more years, or even at least a year, of wage freezes. We may be looking at more employer demands for concessions, particularly in the area of pension plans. This is a huge bombshell, the notion that all of a sudden employers have to come up with 9.5% more money than they did before. It'll be interesting to watch what happens in California as this plays itself out. While we're talking about bargaining, let's talk about some settlements that are out there. We've got four that are from various parts of the country that are pretty interesting settlements. The first comes in San Jose. San Jose has had an extraordinarily troubled labor relations environment involving both police and firefighters in the city of San Jose over the course of the last several years. We have seen city-endorsed, or at least endorsed by city politicians, ballot measures cutting back on retirement benefits and cutting back on binding arbitration. We've seen them pass by the voters of San Jose, rather easily pass, as a matter of fact. We've seen a complete reduction in the staffing in the San Jose Police Department, where you now have less than 1,000 officers doing the work what many, many more hundreds of officers did a while back. We have seen an exodus, in particular in the police department, of long-term police officers going to take jobs elsewhere in the Bay Area as they look at employee pension contributions that are well into the double digits at this point in time. So we've seen just a tremendous amount of turmoil in the San Jose public safety labor relations environment. What has happened in the last few days is that the Police Association, the POA in California and the city, have reached a tentative agreement on changes to the retirement system. And what this tentative agreement is going to do is to impose a two-tiered system for pension benefits. The new tier is going to raise the minimum age for full retirement benefits from age 50 to age 60. And there will be lower benefit formulas as well. The maximum pension, which is now 90% of pay, will be reduced to 65% of pay. Cost of living increases, which are now capped at 3%, will instead be capped at 1.5%. There's still a ratification process on this agreement, but it looks like it has the support of both the city and the POA, though neither side seems at all happy with the situation or happy with what's going on in the labor relations environment, to say the least. Let's move from San Jose over to the other coast and talk about Palm Beach County, Florida. This is another employer that's had a pretty troubled labor relations environment with both firefighters and law enforcement officers for several years, as Florida has really been one of the state's hardest hit by the recession. We have a new short-term contract for firefighters in Palm Beach County. It'll run through 2015. There'll only be one raise, a raise of 3% in October 2014. Starting pay for new hires will be reduced from $49,000 a year to $40,000 a year, and there'll be some modest benefit changes. The contract, for example, will eliminate a $100 annual clothing allowance for firefighters, as well as a $200 annual travel stipend. Let's move up the coast to White Plains, New York, and talk about the fire department in White Plains, fairly large fire department. And we have a contract that covers a four-year period of time, 2010 to 2014. There will be no wage increase in 2010 and 2011. And then there will be 3% raises starting in and retroactive to 2012. The new agreement will move from a fully funded by the employer health insurance plan to one that is an 85-15 split on health care premiums. Under the previous contract, firefighters with over 5 years of service and retirees didn't have to pay anything for health care, and that 15% will apply to them. The last contract, also from the East Coast, this one is a fire department in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Massachusetts police and fire have been pretty much, I don't want to say immune, but they haven't been hit as hard by the recession as police and fire departments in some other areas in the country. But there have been some municipalities that you have seen very difficult bargaining times with, and one of them has been Lawrence, Massachusetts. And what we see with the Lawrence firefighters is a four-year contract that starts on July 1, 2013. There'll be two wage freezes in July 1, 2013 and July 1, 2014, and then two 2.5% increases in the following July 1. So July 1, 2015, 2.5%, same thing, July 1, 2016. The new contract will not involve any monetary concessions by the union. There will be no changes in health care benefits. So while the two wage freezes are a little bit of an anomaly in Massachusetts, you see Massachusetts continuing the trend of ending up with, from an employee standpoint, somewhat better contracts than we see elsewhere around the U.S. What about the national trends beyond these four jurisdictions? We are continuing to see, on the average, for big cities and large counties around the country, we're continuing to see wage increases in the 1 to 2% range per year. These wage increases tend to be coupled with some increased cost shifting towards employees, both on the retirement and health insurance fronts. But for the first time, really since the recession has hit, we are now looking at increases in total compensation. When you take everything into account, wages, health insurance, pensions, other benefits, we're looking at modest increases in total compensation, a far cry from where we were a couple of years ago when we were looking at decreases. While we're talking about bargaining, let's talk about a bargaining issue that's been a fascinating one. In the sense that we don't really have a definitive answer on it yet, and many people are waiting for it. And it involves the installation of GPS systems in police cars. Is that a bargaining event? Does an employer have a legal obligation to collectively bargain over the installation of GPS tracking systems? You would expect that by now we would have an answer to that. Because GPS systems have been around for some time. And yet, to the best of my knowledge, we haven't seen a state labor board weigh in on this at all. And for whatever reason, it just doesn't seem to be an issue that's been litigated to completion. Logically, I would think the result is going to be that there will be something negotiable about the installation of GPS plans. Typically, when you look at what are mandatorily negotiable working conditions, a couple of the indicia of something being mandatory for bargaining are the fact that whatever this thing is concerns safety or that it concerns employee discipline. If something is a safety issue or a discipline issue, it's likely to be mandatory for bargaining. The new case that has come out, and we don't have a decision on it yet, it's just been filed, so it's something you probably want to try to keep tracking, involves a grievance filed by Columbus's police and fire unions over the installation of GPS tracking systems in the police and fire cars. And what the grievance is challenging is not the installation of the system, but rather one of the impacts of the system. And in this case, it's discipline. Police and fire unions are contending that the city has no right to impose any discipline that is based upon information contained from the GPS or contained in the GPS tracking systems unless the city first bargains over that issue. There are informal discussions that are going on between the city and the police and fire unions, but no resolutions yet. What's up next, by the way? I anticipate the next thing we're going to see in this area will be cameras. And I think these are going to be probably specifically a law enforcement issue. The installation of cameras and audio recording devices in police cars. And sometimes the installation of a camera or the placement of a camera and a recording device on a police officer's person. Is that going to be a negotiable event? And I think the rationale is probably much the same as it is with the GPS system. Are there potential disciplinary implications to putting a camera in a police car or putting a camera on an officer's lapel? Maybe. And if so, I think you may well see that an employer has at least an obligation to negotiate over the impacts of the placement of cameras. Let's move from bargaining over to the First Amendment and free speech guarantees under the First Amendment. We've had a slug of First Amendment cases in the last month. I want to talk about three of them that I think are probably the most important. The two of them involve the continuation of what's known as the Garcetti rule. Now let's reset this just a little bit. The Supreme Court several years ago redefined the free speech rights of public employees in a case called Garcetti versus Sabalos. And in that case, a very narrow majority of the Supreme Court held that public employees have no First Amendment rights whatsoever to speak out about something if the speech is made pursuant to their job. In Sabalos' case, Sabalos was an assistant district attorney, and his speech involved a memorandum that he sent through channels containing an allegation that a deputy sheriff with whom he worked, Sabalos was in Los Angeles County, a deputy sheriff with whom he worked was falsifying search warrants affidavits. That speech, of course, if you make a statement like that in a memorandum, the Supreme Court said, look, it's part of Sabalos' job to document those sorts of allegations of misconduct, and thus, since it's part of his job, the speech isn't protected. And there is nothing in the First Amendment that prohibits the employer from disciplining or even firing the employee if the speech is made pursuant to the job. Now, let me pause for a moment and say there may not be anything in the First Amendment that prohibits employer discipline for speech made as part of the job, but if employees have other job rights. For example, if they're covered by a grievance procedure in a collective bargaining agreement or civil service rules or some other job protections, that discipline may not stand. All we're talking about here is discipline when it's considered under the First Amendment. And public employees used to have very rich free speech rights in this area. And you used to see some very, very significant judgments against law enforcement agencies, fire protection agencies, for violating the free speech rights, the civil rights of their employees. Since the Garcetti versus Sabalos case, you just simply don't see those cases very much anymore. And the reason is that on-duty speech is simply not protected under the First Amendment. Now, here are the two latest examples, if we needed any more, of that principle. The first one comes from Bucks County in Pennsylvania, and it involved a deputy sheriff who brought a free speech lawsuit against the employer, alleging that he was discriminated against for making several reports of misconduct by other employees. What the deputy sheriff had said was that firearms instructors lacked proper certification, and he also complained about the fact that the department didn't have policies and procedures related to the use of force. A federal district court threw the lawsuit filed by the deputy out of court, saying, look, these sorts of complaints about inadequate rules and regulations, complaints about how the training system has worked, that's part of a deputy's job. That's what this person is supposed to be doing. And because it's part of the job, there is no prohibition under the First Amendment against the employer disciplining the employee for making such a speech. This case is interesting because this employee also reported a fellow deputy who was sleeping at night, and he reported it up through the chain of command, and he alleged that he was discriminated against for making that report. And the court said, hey, under the department's rules, you have an obligation to take appropriate action when you see another employee engaged in misconduct. That means this speech, reporting your fellow deputy, is speech made pursuant to your job, and that means under Garcetti, it's not protected. The second case comes out of the city of Eugene, Oregon. The name of the case is Reynolds versus City of Eugene. It doesn't involve a public safety officer per se, although it revolves around the Eugene Police Department. And in particular, it involves a woman by the name of Dawn Reynolds, who was hired to be the police auditor that is part of Eugene's Civilian Review Board system. Eventually, Reynolds got in a bad relationship with just about everybody, with her bosses, with people in the police department, with some people in the public, and eventually Reynolds lost her job over the result of that. She brought a free speech lawsuit, and her allegations were that she was terminated in retaliation for her making a number of comments, a number of statements about topics that were a matter of public interest. And what she alleged, for example, was that members of the Civilian Review Board were excluded improperly from the consideration of certain misconduct complaints. She had complaints about whether documents were being inappropriately shredded by the police department, whether or not she and members of the Civilian Review Board were getting access to all of the computer files that she should have gotten access to, those sorts of complaints. The federal court dismissed all of them and said, look, all of those things fall within the scope of her job as a police auditor. She is supposed to raise those sorts of issues in her job, and as such, the speech is non-protected. Now, let's move over to the third free speech case, which I think is a very important one. It comes to us from a federal court of appeals, in this case, the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. We don't see too many of these types of cases coming from federal courts of appeals, and it involves a no-confidence vote conducted by a police union. This is a case, and the name is Ellens versus City of Sierra Madre, California. Ellens was the president of the Sierra Madre Police Association. The association got crosswise in its relationship with the police chief, a woman by the name of Marilyn Diaz, and eventually the police association conducts a no confidence vote. Ellen's lawsuit alleges that after the no confidence vote was conducted, that the chief deliberately and inappropriately delayed signing an application that would have gained him an additional level of law enforcement certification and thus an additional 5% salary increase. In other words, that she's retaliating on the basis of compensation for his having engaged in the no confidence vote, and not just engaged in it, but to coordinating the no confidence vote. A lower court threw out the lawsuit and said it was covered by the Garcetti rule, that these were the no confidence vote involves speech as employees, not speech as citizens, and thus was not protected under the First Amendment. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals completely disagreed with the characterization of the lawsuit and reinstated the lawsuit. And some of the words of the Ninth Circuit, I think, are very interesting. The court adopts a position that had been taken by several other courts, most notably the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Illinois, Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in a case involving an Ohio police department. And that distinction is that when a police officer or firefighter takes off their uniform and puts on their union hat, the Garcetti rule doesn't apply, and that speech is potentially protected under the First Amendment. And the Ninth Circuit adopts that distinction. And here are the words of the Ninth Circuit in this case. I'll just read you three sentences that talk about the Ninth Circuit's approach to this type of case, no confidence vote. Ellens, that's the president of the POA here, stated in his declaration that he led the no confidence vote due to the chief's lack of leadership, wasting of citizens' tax dollars, hypocrisy, expensive paranoia, and damaging inability to conduct her job. The chief does not contend that any of the grievances motivating the vote were individual as opposed to collective. Indeed, the record suggests the police union's concerns were with Diaz's leadership style and other department-wide problems, not private grievances. These departmental problems were of inherent interest to the public because they could affect the ability of the Sierra Madre police force to attract and retain officers. What about whether Ellens was speaking as a citizen or speaking as an officer? The court says Ellens introduced evidence that he led the no-confidence vote and issued the related press releases in his capacity as a union representative. His daily professional duties as a police officer did not include acting as a union representative or serving as the president of the association. The court even says, given the inherent institutional conflict of interest between an employer and its employees' union, we conclude that a police officer does not act in furtherance of his public duties when speaking as a representative of the police union. The court sent the case back down to the trial court for a trial on the merits of Ellen's claims. Next up is a case out of New Mexico that will be of interest to you if you're from a right-to-work state where there's the possibility that individuals can be in a bargaining unit but do not have to be members of the labor organization. New Mexico is a right-to-work state, and this is a case involving a police officer named David Lugenbull, who was a full-time police officer for the Gallup, New Mexico Police Department. Lugenbull decided not to join the union, never paid dues, never sought the assistance of the association. Eventually, Lugenbull was fired. And when he was fired, he filed a grievance under the grievance procedure in the collective bargaining agreement between the city and the Gallup Police Officers Association. The grievance was denied. Lugenbull pushed the grievance through the various steps of the grievance procedure, but when he got to the fourth step, which is binding arbitration, decided not to seek binding arbitration and instead filed a lawsuit in court challenging his termination. Lugenbull's argument was that since he was not an association member, he had a right to bring a lawsuit directly against the city. The New Mexico Court of Appeals says, wrong. The court said that, look, all members of the bargaining unit are covered by this grievance procedure, whether they are members of the union or not members of the union. The court says that for decades, New Mexico case law and federal case law have recognized that the terms and conditions of the contract, including a grievance procedure and including binding arbitration, apply to all members of the bargaining unit. And the court's bottom line is Lugenbull's bound by the contract to follow the grievance procedure through to its conclusion, meaning to seek binding arbitration. The court doesn't address a point that probably is worth talking about. And that is, what if this grievance procedure, like most grievance procedures, only allows the association to refer a grievance to arbitration, doesn't allow individual members access to the grievance procedure? What would the result be then? And I think the answer probably would be that a court would say that the association owes a duty of fair representation to Lugenbull as a non-member. That duty of fair representation requires it to consider his request for arbitration in a non-discriminatory manner. In other words, not saying no simply because he's a non-member, and to consider his request for arbitration following fair procedures. But that if it does so, if it acts in a non-discriminatory and fair manner, the association would be free not to refer the case to arbitration, just like it would be free not to refer a member's challenge to arbitration. I think that would be the likely result. There's a lot of cases from other states that stand for that proposition. Let's move next door now to Texas and a Very surprising decision, and I've got to say, I think a wrong decision from the Texas Supreme Court. And this is the question of whether or not Weingarten rights being the right to representation in a disciplinary interview, exist under Texas law. Once again, we have to take a little bit of a step back before delving into this recent case. Weingarten rights come to us from a 1975 decision of the United States Supreme Court. Weingarten's a private sector case, and in Weingarten, the Supreme Court held that Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act granted private sector employees the right to have a union representative present at an investigatory interview whenever the employee reasonably believes that discipline could result from the interview. And Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act grants employees the right to act in a concerted manner for purposes of mutual aid or protection. Weingarten, because it's a private sector case, doesn't automatically apply to public sector agencies. And as a result, we've seen the adoption of the Weingarten rule, or modification of the Weingarten rule, on a state-by-state basis. Usually this is done through state labor boards or labor commissions. Sometimes you've seen this happen through court systems. But what can be said is that up until a few weeks ago, every state that had considered the issue had found that something in a state collective bargaining law, whether it be the right to collectively bargain, or sometimes it might be an independent source, gave the right to employees to representation in a disciplinary process. Usually these would be characterized as Weingarten rights. Sometimes, for example, there's a New York case that came out a couple of years ago saying, we're not adopting Weingarten, but we find the right to representation elsewhere in our state laws. But every state that's considered the issue has found the right to representation to exist somewhere as a function of the collective bargaining system or a state statutory scheme. Enter the Texas Supreme Court and a case called City of Round Rock versus Rodriguez. This comes out of the Round Rock, Texas Fire Department. The fire chief called a firefighter by the name of Rodriguez into a meeting in the chief's office. What was the meeting about? The chief suspected that Rodriguez was using sick leave so that he could get a physical examination as part of applying to be a firefighter in the Austin Fire Department, real close to Round Rock geographically. So there's potential disciplinary implications to this meeting because, of course, this would be sick leave abuse. Rodriguez asks for a union representative. The fire chief says no, and the litigation starts. And what the Texas Supreme Court has to decide is whether or not a Texas statute, and this is a statute that is, believe it or not, 100 years old or so. It's called Section 101.001 of the Texas Labor Code, whether or not a Texas statute granted employees the equivalent of Weingarten rights. The Supreme Court of Texas wasn't speaking on entirely a blank slate. There'd been at least a couple of decisions by lower courts, Texas courts of appeals, saying that Weingarten rights were in fact part and parcel of this Section 101.001, and many more trial court decisions that had found that. The Texas Supreme Court, though, says no. The court says Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act is different than our statute. We don't find the concerted activities language in our statute. Thus, we don't think that there is the right to representation built into this very, very old statute. And here are some words from the Texas Supreme Court. The court says, in Texas, we have no National Labor Relations Board equivalent. Instead, labor policy and regulation is determined exclusively by the Texas legislature and the language of its legislative enactments. And unlike the United States Congress, the Texas legislature hasn't enacted legislation to confer the right to union representation on Texas public sector employees during investigatory interviews. In the end, what the court says is the fact that the statute is silent on the issue means that it must infer that the legislature did not intend to grant the right to representation. Here are the words from the court. We must give effect to the statute's silence on the issue and the legislature's decision not to confer representation rights akin to Weingarten rights on Texas public sector employees. While this court may properly write in areas traditionally reserved to the judicial branch of government, it would be a usurpation of our powers to add language to a law where the legislature has refrained. I mentioned at the start that I think the Supreme Court got this wrong. Why do I think that? Well, the court is basically saying, look, unless the right to representation is written into the collective bargaining statute, it doesn't exist. There is no right to representation written into Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. The Supreme Court found that the right to representation was implicit in the National Labor Relations Act, as indeed have labor boards and courts involving state collective bargaining laws all around the country. By the way, those court decisions from around the country, curiously not referenced whatsoever in the Texas Supreme Court's decision. The court's chief justice in Texas issued what I would call a fairly vigorous dissenting opinion, and what the justice argues, and he was joined by another justice, is that the failure of the legislature to act was an implicit conclusion that Weingarten rights did in fact exist under Texas law and didn't have to be specifically adopted. The dissenting judges said, look, the legislature knows how to limit public employee union activities when it wants to. And it left Section 101.001 untouched, even in the wake of Weingarten, even in the wake of these lower court of appeals decisions that we've had for years that recognize Weingarten rights. The fact that it left it untouched meant that the legislature we should consider the legislature satisfied that Weingarten rights were being properly recognized in Texas. But in the end, it doesn't really matter if the Texas Supreme Court is right or wrong. As a Supreme Court justice, a United States Supreme Court justice once said, we are not final because we are right. We are right because we are final. And what that means is for Texas public employees, if you want the right to representation, Texas public employees are going to have to convince the Texas legislature and Governor Rick Perry to adopt a statute that specifically grants the right to representation. Let's move on over to California now, and a law enforcement officer who lost his job due to the Brady Rule. And let's talk about the continuation of his lawsuit and really what is becoming, I think, a very troubling situation where we find officers who end up getting placed on what are usually called Brady lists and end up without an effective way of challenging that placement. This is a case involving a Torrance police officer by the name of Rehan Nazir, Torrance, California police officer. Nazir's difficulties stemmed from an arrest that he made in 2007. He prepared what was called a probable cause declaration, listing the probable cause that he had to make the arrest, and he deliberately excluded from the declaration reference to the fact that he had a confidential informant. Nazir testified that was common practice in the Torrance Police Department not to list the fact that confidential informants provided part of the basis for a probable cause declaration. Later, the defendant's attorney learns of the confidential informant, files a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, and the DA's office grants the motion to dismiss, dismiss the criminal charges, and the DA's motion dismisses the charges. The DA's office, this is the LA County DA's office, has created what it calls a Brady list. It's Think of it as kind of an internal repository of information to facilitate compliance with discovery obligations under the Supreme Court's Brady versus Maryland decision. And the whole idea here is that an officer can end up on the Brady list if the DA's office comes into possession of information indicating that the officer may have been dishonest. There's even a unit, it's called the Brady Compliance Unit in the DA's office, that does nothing other than conduct investigations into whether officers should be placed on the Brady list. And this unit investigated Nazir, found he should be placed on the list, and he was. Nazir was given the opportunity by the DA's office to file written objections. He did, but the DA's office didn't change its mind. As a result, Nazir lost his job. The Torrance Police Department fired him. He challenged his termination on equal protection grounds, lodging, among other things, race discrimination charges. He lost in federal court. The court found that his placement on the Brady list was an independent reason for his discharge and was a legitimate business reason on the part of the employer. Nazir then filed a state court lawsuit alleging that his placement by the DA's office on the Brady list, that placement violated his rights under California's statutory Public Safety Officers Bill of Rights. There's a section in the Bill of Rights that basically requires hearings before punitive action is taken against a public safety officer. The question in the case is the DA's office bound by the Bill of Rights when it puts a police officer, one it doesn't employ, one that works for another agency, on the Brady list? And the California Court of Appeals says, no, the Bill of Rights does not apply to the DA's office in this situation. The court says that the right to a hearing plainly provides that peace officers must be afforded an administrative appeal when punitive actions are taken against them, but that has to be considered in the context of the entire Bill of Rights, which prohibits public employees from adverse or punitive actions taken by their employers. The court's bottom line is that the Bill of Rights cannot reasonably be read to authorize a Bill of Rights claim against a non-employing public agency wholly unrelated to the peace officer's employing agency. And that means that California peace officers, and this is primarily police officers that we'd be talking about, though the Bill of Rights applies to firefighters as well, but the Brady list issue is primarily a peace officer issue. What this means is they're in very much the same situation as Texas public employees. If they want a change in this rule, the change is going to have to come from the legislature. The legislature is going to have to enact a statute that would require some sort of hearing rights prior to the placement on a Brady list. And if that gets set up, then that may raise all sorts of interesting and complicated constitutional issues about the right of the legislature to affect prosecutorial discretion. But we'll see. We'll talk about that more if and when we ever get to that point in California. Next up, our latest FLSA case involving claims for compensation for on-call time, and our latest unsuccessful FLSA case involving claims for compensation for on-call time. These cases have been notoriously difficult for firefighters and police officers to bring. They essentially have to argue that the restrictions placed on their off-duty time by a on-call or standby program are so significant that it effectively deprives them of the ability to use their off-duty life for personal purposes. That's a hurdle that's been almost impossible to cross. There are dozens and dozens of unsuccessful on-call FLSA cases brought by firefighters and police officers. And the latest one comes out of the town of West Yellowstone, Montana. It's a group of police officers suing the city under the FLSA. West Yellowstone, Montana is a seasonal town. It's one of the kind of resort-type towns, vacation-type towns that surrounds Yellowstone Park. And during the summer, West Yellowstone will receive hundreds of thousands of visitors, maybe even millions of visitors in the summer months. During the off-season, and particularly when snow sets in and all sorts of tourist facilities close, the population shrinks tremendously. The town only has 4 police officers, and it uses a schedule where officers work 3/12s 1 week, and then 4/12s the following week. So in other words, they work a total of 84 hours in a 14-day work period. Under the FLSA, that's no particular problem. Under Section 7K of the FLSA, the overtime threshold for a 14-day work period is 86 hours, so this schedule does not generate overtime. What were the officers' difficulties? They were required to be on call for the 12-hour period that immediately preceded each work shift. So 3 days 1 week, 4 days the next, they were required to be on call for a 12-hour period of time. The on-call requirement obligated officers to provide backup in dangerous situations. Officers were given cell phones and expected to be reachable at all times. They had to stay within the service areas of the cell phones, and that's not all that far in West Yellowstone. Of course, they had to respond immediately because there'd really only be one officer on duty at any one moment in time, almost all of the time. They had to respond immediately, be in police clothing, have their gear, and respond in their patrol cars. If they actually responded, they would get 2.5 hours of overtime pay, a minimum of 2.5 hours of overtime pay. But if they didn't respond, they wouldn't get any compensation for their on-call time. A group of these officers filed a lawsuit, went to a jury trial. Jury ruled against the officers, and the officers challenged the jury's decision in the Montana Supreme Court, which upheld the jury's findings. The court pointed to the fact that the officers spent much of their on-call time asleep, eating meals, doing household chores, watching movies, going around town, that sort of thing. The court pointed to the fact that the officers received relatively few call-outs and had not been disciplined in the instances where they missed a call. In addition, officers testified that treating on-call responsibilities was at least theoretically possible, and in the end, the court said, you put all this together, and the fact that we are just reviewing a jury's verdict where all we need is any probative evidence in order to uphold the verdict, we don't have a basis to overturn the jury's findings, and thus the on-call time is not compensable. Next up, we've got a very significant arbitration case, I think, coming out of California, San Joaquin County, California, dealing with the remedies that are available in a disciplinary case. This isn't a public safety case, it's a public employer case, but because this arbitrator does such a thorough job of discussing potential arbitration remedies, and because she's a good arbitrator, Bonnie Bogue is her name, and she's in the National Academy of Arbitrators and is well recognized as a good arbitrator. I think it's worth spending a little bit of time with respect to this case. This is an employee who was wrongfully discharged. The arbitrator had already concluded that the termination was not for just cause, and then sent it back, the case back to the parties, the county and the union, to try to figure out remedies, and they couldn't. And so they sent the remedial issues back to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator had to decide a wide variety of remedial questions. First up, was the employee entitled to compensation for missed overtime? The employer said no. The employee wanted all the overtime. Pretty much anybody in the Western world had worked in her absence. And the arbitrator says, look, first of all, employees are entitled to missed overtime as a remedy in a disciplinary case, provided they can establish that it is reasonably probable that they would have worked the overtime. Remedies can't be speculative, but rather they have to be grounded on, in this case, persuasive evidence of the amount of the overtime the employee would have worked. In this case, the arbitrator concluded that the employee demonstrated, I'm quoting here, a significant and consistent pattern of taking overtime work, and that she would have worked more overtime than did her replacement because of her expertise and years of experience. The arbitrator ended up concluding that the employee would have worked an average of 3.7 overtime hours per month and ordered that the county include that in the remedial portion of implementing her award. Then the arbitrator turned to health care. And the employee's health care prior to discharge had both an employer component, employer paid premium, and the employee paid premium. In the discussions leading up to the arbitrator's remedy issue, the county had already restored the employee's medical, dental, and vision benefits as if she'd never had a break in service, and also told the employee that she could submit any claims for any expenses that were not covered. The arbitrator found the county was on the right track, but wanted the county to do a little bit more. What is that more? Here's the arbitrator again. Instead of a retroactive restoration of benefits, the employee is entitled to a make-whole award reimbursing her for out-of-pocket medical, dental, or vision expenses she had to pay that would have been covered had she been covered by the county's plan, and or for her contribution or premiums paid to obtain medical care coverage during the period of her separation. The arbitrator then turned to pension contributions. And as was the case with medical insurance, there was both an employer and an employee component to pension contributions. The employee actually took the position with the arbitrator that she wanted the employer to pay the employee contribution on a retroactive basis during the period of the discharge. So, in other words, the employee wanted the employer to pay both the employer and employee contribution. Arbitrator says, nope, that goes too far. Requiring the employee to pay her own contribution is, in the arbitrator's words, consistent with the law and places her in the same position she would have been in had she not been terminated. The arbitrator then turned to leave accruals. How do you handle leave accruals during the period of the discharge? And I don't need to go into the position staked out by the employee and the employer on leave accruals and the various types of leave, but the arbitrator ends up saying, look, what we have to do is put this employee back into the position that she would have been in but for the discharge, and that means she is entitled to all vacation and sick leave accruals she would have earned but for her termination, including compensation for all paid holidays. Last up for the arbitrator was the employee's request for attorney's fees. The arbitrator said, no, you don't get attorney's fees in arbitration. That's not the norm. It's only a rare case, usually when you have language in a collective bargaining agreement that allows the recovery of attorney's fees in arbitration. The arbitrator talks about the issue of attorney's fees at some length and talks about how under what's known as the American rule, that in litigation and in arbitration, as well as court litigation, each party is generally expected to pay their own attorney's fees. Let's wind up this podcast with the numbers. The Consumer Price Index, we are still seeing very moderate numbers. The CPI from all four regions, the Northeast, South, Midwest, and West, is increasing at a rate of 1.3% to 1.4% per year. Medical costs continue to be tamped down. They're increasing at a rate of 3.2% per year, way down from the double-digit numbers we saw 2 to 3 years ago. And that's it for this month's podcast. We hope you join us in June for our next First Thursday.